So first of all, good morning to everybody. Thanks to be here, virtually, of course. What I would like to do today is to discuss a little bit about the history and the role of vacuum tubes, and in particular, diodes, triodes, and pentodes. So I have been really pleased to listen to the seminar about the history of transistor by Cantin, and I wanted to somehow give another historical insight about such vacuum tubes. So I will be, so here is the plan of my presentation. I will be starting discussing about radio, because radio is one of the reasons why electronics is born, and in particular such vacuum tubes have been developed. We are starting saying something about vacuum diodes and thermionic diodes, and I will be somehow presenting for a few minutes the characterization techniques for such kinds of components, so vintage and modern car tracers. Then I will be discussing about triodes, pentodes. I will be presenting some examples, and I will be finishing with a conclusion. So let's start at the end of the 19th century. We are in a context where the radio was invented, basically. Depending on the place of the world, you have different scientists or inventors that worked on the radio. So one of the most well-known is Guglielmo Marconi, working at the beginning in Italy and then in England. And elsewhere, there were a lot of other people, Popov, Tesla, because basically 10, 15 years earlier, there were the experiments from Hertz and the development of the electromagnetism that showed that theoretically and practically that on at least at short distances for the time, you can have the propagation of electromagnetic waves. So here we see the equipment used by Marconi, the receiver, the transmitter on the left and the receiver on the right. And at the beginning, they were pretty simple devices. We're going to discuss a little bit how they worked, and we will be able to understand some of the problems that vacuum tubes have tried to solve. What is interesting for us is to know that at the beginning, those were untuned circuits. So basically, they were emitting radio waves on a very large spectrum for the emitter, and the receiver was receiving them and detect them. There is some music. I don't know, someone can switch off the micro. Okay. So, now, another important advance at the end of 19th century was the discovery of electron, in particular by Joseph John Thomson in 1897. So, he won the Nobel Prize in Physics a few years afterwards, and Thomson was working on particular vacuum tubes. We are not going to discuss a lot about cathode ray tubes here, but basically, they were one of the first example of vacuum tubes to be used, and one of the last category of vacuum tubes to be exploited in televisions until a few years after 2000. So basically, he was studying the property of cathode rays. Now we know that the cathode rays are made of electrons. He was able to measure the deflection of an electric field that was obtained with plates on cathode ray tubes, on cathode rays, and basically determine the ratio between the mass and the charge of electrons. he did a certain number of other experiments and deduced that electron was the unit of charge that was responsible of currents and this kind of things. At the moment, the term electronics did not exist yet. So let's come back to radio and let's see what are the challenges that are associated to the radio. So on the left, you have a schematic of a transmitter similar to the one that Marconi and the first radio inventors used at the end of 19th century and beginning of 20th century. And basically, you have three problems. The first one is to create a high-frequency signal. Then you need to modulate them in order to carry an information, and then you need to radiate them so that they can propagate to the receiver. So if we have a look at the schematic, basically it's a very simple system, and the core of that system is the Ruhmkorff coil. And the Ruhmkorff coil is a sort of, it's a transformer basically, that is used also as a electromagnet. And you have a telegraphic key. If you want to transmit a signal, the telegraphic key is depressed, energizes the system. At the beginning, the contact I is closed. The coil are energized. The electromagnet applies a force on the contact I. The contact I are moved, are opened, and therefore the circuit is de-energized. However, when the circuit is de-energized, the contact I close again, and you have a cycle that is repeated, like on a bell, basically, on an electric bell. So this is basically a mechanical oscillator, where the contact I is continuously switched on and off. The coil has a very large inductance, so it can create very large voltages when the contact I is switched off. And on the secondary of that transformer, you have a very large voltage that can create a spark between two contacts of a spintronometer. A spark is a very fast phenomenon, and this means that it can radiate, can create a high frequency basically, and the signal is radiated by the antenna. So this is a untuned circuit. The quality factor of the circuit is very, very low, but it's able to radiate signals on a very wide frequency band. The receiver is also a simple circuit. You have three problems. The first one, you want to receive a signal, and for that you have an antenna. Then you want to detect them, basically rectify them, so create a sort of a low-frequency signal from the high frequency that is received by the antenna, and then you want to have something that allows you to be notified whether a signal is received or not. So the core of the system is the detection here, and is done, was done at the time with a sort of a magic component that was called a coherer. And this is a component that was relatively simple, invented by a French physicist, Braly. It was two electrodes in a glass tube that were touching a certain quantity of metal filings. And the metal filings were partially oxidized, so you have a plenty of contacts between metal, oxide, and this kind of things. Depending on the coherer, one of the phenomena that happens is that when the coherer is subjected to a high-frequency field, the metal filings cohere, and so basically they cling together, and their overall resistivity drops. So basically, if you apply a battery in the system, you can make a DC current pass through the coherer, and the current can be sufficient to ring a bell if a HF signal is received by the antenna. The problem of the coherer is that you had to tap, to move physically the metal filings to reset the coherer and recover a high resistance situation where you can receive again and detect again an HF signal. So it's a bulky system. It worked in 1895 and 97. You don't have any amplification, but here basically you don't have any kind of selectivity. You have a large wide bandwidth signal emitted by the emitter. You receive almost everything by the receiver, and you hope for the best. So we are at the beginning of the 1901, so beginning of the 20th century, and let's start with a fail. The situation is that Marconi founded a company and wanted to sell his components, his radio, and in order to advertise the advantages of the radios, he tried to provide a fast way to report results to the press in the 1901 New York yacht race. The problem was that he wasn't alone at this moment working on radio, and in particular, an American inventor, Lee DeForest, who was almost the same age as Marconi, had the same idea. So you have two untuned emitters operating at the same time, you have two untuned receivers operating at the same time, you have a big mess. And so basically the journalists weren't able to receive anything with the radio. So it was a big fail. However, in the same year, in December, Marconi was able to emit and receive a signal, the first radio transmission across the Atlantic Ocean. And this was an accomplishment because at the beginning, many people were dubious that the radio signals would offer advantages with respect to visual communications, basically, because they were thought to be having light, and without realizing that the radio signals can follow the curvature of the Earth. In reality, this accomplishment, which played probably a big part on the Marconi 1909 Nobel Prize in Physics, was made possible by the work of Jean-Ambroise Fleming, who was an electrician and worked on the emitter in particular, because of the, in order to have a high range communication, a very large power was needed by the emitter. Fleming didn't, apparently hadn't a lot of recognition for this accomplishment, but got interested in radio. And this played a role because he was aware of the problems that were associated to the radio. And in those years, he began working on the detection of signals. And in particular, in 1903, he developed the Fleming diode. That was the first vacuum tube able to rectify a signal that can be used for detection and rectification. So in reality, this wasn't something new because thermionic effects were discovered almost 30 years previously. Guthrie, in particular, noticed that an electroscope could be charged or discharged by approaching a metal bell that has been previously heated. Edison was working on light bulbs and tried to understand why the interior of the glass envelope was blackened during the the life of the light bulbs. And he put an electrode, tried to understand something, and recognized that a current could pass between the filament that is hot and the third electrode that he placed inside of the glass envelope. Owen Richardson worked on the thermionic emission, but Fleming was the first to recognize that such a component could be used for detecting radio signals. And so the Fleming diode, it's a very simple component where you have a glass envelope where you have vacuum inside. You have a filament that emits electrons because it's hot by thermal emission, thermionic emission, and the electrons can be gathered by a plate if the plate is positive. If the plate is negative, there is no current that can pass through the system because basically the anode does not emit electrons because it's cold. So basically you have a system that is asymmetric, and the asymmetry is translated in the electrical world in an asymmetry of the characteristics. This is the so-called direct heating cathode. You can have an indirect heated cathode where you separate the filament with the cathode that is physically emitting electrons. So at this time, we have components that are pretty similar to light bulbs, basically. And we had the first component, the first electronic component that can be used for the detection and rectification, and was much better than the computer that Marconi was using previously. So how tube characteristics are measured? So at the beginning, this is a picture from a book written in 1927. People, of course, you need to heat up the filament, and people were applying different voltages, measuring current in the plate with respect to the filament by hand, and tracing characteristics point by point, basically. The first curve tracer, so an automatic system that was able to draw the characteristics curves of vacuum tubes was probably invented around 1938. And this was a moment where oscilloscopes began to be used in the domain. And therefore, basically, in this system, an oscilloscope in XY mode, an oscillograph, as it was named back then, could be used to draw a family of characteristics representing the behavior of the tube under test at different voltages and currents. Of course, the history has continued. 1969 is the moment where transistors become to be widely used in such a measuring device. Here we have two examples, the Tektronix 577 and the Tektronix 576, almost the same era. And I'm going to show you some measurements in the rest of this presentation done on the Tektronix 577. Of course, the problem of the first modern curve tracers was that there were analog circuits, and there was no way to treat the data in an automatic way. When computers became widespread, it was extremely convenient to have computers to record the data and to help you treat the data. And so at the end of 1980s, you began finding curve tracers that could record and let you manipulate the data in a convenient way. So the HP 4155, and nowadays probably some of you are acquainted with the K calcite B1500A. So let's come back to vacuum tubes. Let's come back to diodes, and let's see what is the characteristic of a vacuum diode, and let's compare it to a modern variety, not so modern, but with a semiconductor diode. So here I selected a vacuum tube from 1937. So it's a 5Y3GD. That is a full wave rectifier. So in the glass envelope, here the size is approximately 15 centimeters. You have two diodes with a common cathode. You have one filament. You have to count 5 volts and 1.6 amperes, so 8 watts only to light the filament. And so this is wasted power, basically, yeah, just to make sure that the system can rectify a signal. And here is the characteristics. So the characteristics is shown on the screen of the Tektronix 577. I had to draw the reticule digitally because the original one is not very visible. So on the right, you have the version where the reticule has been enhanced digitally. And you see the characteristics of the 5Y3GD. The scale is 10 volts per division horizontally and 10 milliamperes per division vertically. So you see immediately that the characteristics, the zero is in the middle. The characteristics is asymmetrical, as we expect from a diode. And the forward drop, so if you have a rectified current of 50 milliamperes, you have a forward drop of 27 volts. So if you have, if you want to rectify a power supply of 300 volts, you can afford losing 27 volts for the voltage drop of the diode. But if you want to rectify a small signal, this is probably not the best choice you can do. You can compare it with a semiconductor diode, so it's the 1N4007. That is probably the simplest rectifying diode that you can possibly find. Dating back from 1960s, nothing really fancy or recent, where for the same current you have 0.7 volts. And here the characteristics is practically ideal. You have a straight line if you compare it with the 5Y3GB. So there have been other techniques to improve the characteristics of such diode. But coming back to the radio, another problem that people try to improve was the sensitivity of the receiver. And we meet again Lee DeForest. Lee DeForest had a life where he had some brilliant accomplishments. Big fails. There was a dispute between Fleming and Lee DeForest because Fleming accused DeForest to have stolen the idea of the diode. So it's a pretty controversial person, but in any case, in 1906, he had the idea of putting a control grid between the filament and the anode of the DeForest diode. So the idea is the following one. You have the filament that is hot and its electrons. If the plate is positive, the electrons are can pass towards the anode, but the grid applies an electrostatic field that can either let the electrons pass through it and go to the plate, or somehow avoid that the electrons can reach the plate. So basically it's something that is able to control the flow of electrons between the filament and the anode, and therefore providing amplification, because basically the electrons, if the grid is kept negative, are not going into the grid, so the current in the grid is very low. So here you can have direct heating or indirect heating. You have the amplification that is possible by this device, made possible by this device, and for me this is the real birth of electronics. It's the moment where you have the first active device that can be used in an electrical circuit. So what is like a typical characteristics of a triode? So here I've selected a small triode, one half of the ECC82, that is the double triode. So you have two triodes in the same glass envelope. It's a pretty common tube that you find in guitar amplifiers, among other things. Basically, here you have a family of characteristics, because on the horizontal axis you have the plate voltage, on the vertical axis you have the plate current, and each one of those characteristics is measured for a different voltage applied to the grid. So if you have 0 volt, basically here I have only traced the positive voltages for the anode, but you have something that is pretty similar to the characteristics of the diode that we have seen earlier. The current would have been zero for negative values of the anode voltage. If you apply a negative voltage on the grid, basically you shift towards the right the characteristics. And basically, the more is negative the voltage on the grid, the more difficult is for the electrons to pass from the cathode to the anode. So here you have selected the bias point. Usually you use such a components like transistors for amplifying signals by choosing a bias point and by moving around the bias point. For minus 8.5 volts on the grid, 250 volts on the plate, you have 10 milliamps that is passing in the triode. So if you look at this characteristics here, probably my description has made you think about n-channel MOSFETs, in particular depletion ones. The characteristics do not look very much like transistors. But this is an idea that can help if you want to understand a little bit how such a component can be used. So, very rapidly, if you have studied electronics with transistors, you know that people like to do small signal analysis in circuits. And you can do exactly the same thing with triodes. You define a certain number of parameters that are the small signal parameters of the triode in around the working point. And the first parameter that you find in datasheets is the amplification factor, so mu, is the derivative of the gate voltage with respect to the anode voltage with respect to the grid voltage. And so this is the maximum amplification voltage gain that you can obtain from this triode in the working point. But you also have to consider an internal resistance that somehow limits the power that you can extract from this triode. So you can create an equivalent model that is composed by a controlled voltage source and an internal resistance. This is the model that you find very often in datasheets for the triodes, but you also can do a Norton equivalent, and you can describe the behavior of the triode around the bias point by using a transconductance and the same internal resistance. So you can think about vacuum tube has something that can apply a transconductance, and therefore something that is pretty similar. This is the same model, the one on the top right is the same model that you use for transistors, in particular for MOSFETs at low frequency in analog circuits. If you compare vacuum tubes with respect to bipolar transistors, usually something that can be interesting is to compare the transconductance ratio with respect to the drain current for bipolar or BJT or MOSFETs. And if we do the same thing for the vacuum tubes, we have a very low transconductance efficiency, 0.22 volts to the minus one. If you do the same calculation for a bipolar junction transistor, you find a value that is two orders of magnitude larger. So what does it mean? This means that basically transistors, and in particular bipolar transistors, have a lot of gain with respect to such devices. So here is a circuit description. I haven't described the working principles of the tubes. So, this reference is pretty good. Now you have the references at the end of the presentation. If you want to understand what is the physics of the thermionic emission, the electrostatic field inside of the triode, etc., you can have a look at this. At this book here. So from a circuit point of view, you have something that can be used basically in three ways, exactly as you do with transistors in analog electronics. If I'm taking a MOS transistor, you have three basic circuits, is the common source, is the common drain, and the common gate. And with a triode, you have exactly the same thing. You have three circuits, the common cathode, providing a negative voltage amplification, high input impedance relatively, and moderate output impedance. You have a common plate where you have a relatively low output impedance, but you have a voltage gain that is close to one. And you have the common grid, where you have a low input impedance, a moderate output impedance, and a positive voltage gain. So it's the same as transistor. You have the same building blocks, but you don't have a complementary devices. If you have a transistor, you have NPN and PNP, or N-channel and P-channel. In vacuum tubes, you only have N-channel devices. So this means that some... you have less flexibility with respect to transistors when you use vacuum tubes. For example, you can't have a push-pull amplifier built by vacuum tubes alone. You need to have a transformer in order to shift the phase at the output of your circuit. And in general, operating with triodes, you have a relatively low amplification. One solution to the low amplification problem has been found in 1950. And the idea has come from a German physicist, Walter Schottky. I believe it's the same Schottky well known for the Schottky junction metal semiconductor. Quite an accomplishment. The idea is to put a second grid between the control grid that is is kept negative and is used to control the flux of electron between the cathode and the anode. And the idea of the second grid that is kept positive but not as positive as the anode is to electrostatically shield the control grid. So if you put an electrostatic shield between the control grid and the anode, basically electrons around the control grid cannot see, while they're passing through the control grid, the electrostatic influence of the plate. So if you want to increase the gain, you have two possibilities. Either you increase the transconductance or you increase the internal resistance. here, since the flow of electrons becomes much less dependent on the voltage that you're applying on the plate, what you do is that you are increasing the internal resistance of the tube. So this works very well, and basically if you look at the characteristics on the right around the bias point, you see that the characteristics are horizontal. So basically if you increase the resistance, means that those characteristics become flat and horizontal. The problem that you have is that you have this strange phenomenon here in for low plate voltages, where you have a zone of negative resistance. So when you don't seek for negative resistance and you find it, usually that can be a problem. If you use this vacuum tube as an amplifier and you expect it to work in the bias point that I have shown in the picture here, so Q 350 volts, 12 milliamps, and minus 5 volts for the control grid. And for a reason or another, while your circuit, your amplifier is being used, you have signals that go in the zone where you have negative resistance in your vacuum tube, you can have parasitic oscillations, you can have audible distortions, it's a mess. So this is called the T-trode kink. It was a problem and was due to the secondary emissions of electrons from the anode. You have electrons emitted by the cathode are accelerated towards the anode. Electrons impinges on the anode. They are quite fast. They can extract other electrons that can be around the plate. If the voltage on the plate is relatively low, basically, those electrons are attracted by the screen grid that is negative with respect to the anode, and you have a current that instead of going into the anode goes in the screen grid, and therefore you have the negative resistance that is creating a mess in the characteristics. So that was a problem. However, if you try to calculate the gain that we can possibly have around the bias point that I have chosen, the transconductance hasn't increased, but the resistance has, the internal resistance has increased quite a lot, and you gain one or two order of magnitudes with respect to triodes. This configuration here is also a natural cascode configuration. Therefore, you also have advantages with respect to the role of the different capacitances. So this is a vacuum tube that can be used at high frequency. Oh, by the way, this is not a real T-trode because I didn't have one of those. I use a pentode in the so-called T-trode mode. It's a particular connection of the grid. So the solution of the T-trode kink came in 1926 by the invention of pentodes. This is something that has been done in Philips by Bernard Telegen. He was 26 years old at the time. He hadn't finished it because Telegen has worked on circuit analysis and there is a theorem that bears his name. So, you know, in analog electronics, you don't have the Nobel Prizes. In device physics, you can, but in circuit analysis, in circuit techniques, no. And the equivalent of the Nobel Prize is when you have a theorem or a circuit configuration that is named upon you. So, Telegen is known for that. So, the problem came from the secondary emitted electrons from the plate, and Telegen in 1926 had the idea of putting a third grid. It's not tightly wound, so it's quite an open grid. It's kept at 0 volts, so it's most of the times it's connected to the cathode directly. And if you have secondary emitted electrons that come from the anode, basically the suppressor's grid pushes them back towards the anode. And therefore, you get rid completely of T-trode kink that was visible in the characteristics of the previous slide. So here I've used a pentode. I've used that as a pentode. In the previous slide, basically, I tied the suppressor and the screen grid together. Here, I have tied the suppressor grid to the cathode, so cathode 0 volt, and we have the characteristics. And if I'm hiding the scales here, and I'm not showing you that we are working with hundreds of volts, this is a characteristic is pretty similar to the one of a transistor, bipolar or maybe MOS transistor, something like that. So I have selected a similar working point, 350 volts, 12.5 milliamps, minus 1 volt for the control grid. Internal resistance about 3 and something, 100 kilo ohms, and amplification factor of 1400. So an improvement with respect to triads. So it's the pentode was an invention patented by Philips, and in particular in the Anglo-Saxon world, many tried to have the same results without infringing Philips patent. And so, a notable invention was the Kinkless tetrode, so KT, where instead of using a suppressor grid, basically they shaped an electrode in such a way that it was sufficient to get rid of the problem of the secondary emission electrons, but wasn't infringing Philips patent. Those components can be used almost as they were patented. So this is a KT88. Kinkless tetrode 88, and this is pretty popular among enthusiasts of guitar amplifiers. So something that we can notice here that is not specific to this kind of vacuum tube, but is general, is the getter. Every vacuum tube has a part where the there is something inside that appears like a mirror, is a metallic deposition inside of the glass envelope, and this is pretty normal, is perfect, perfectly normal, and is a reactive material that has been deposited in order to remove gas molecules. So it's something that can absorb them or can react with them. So it's a vacuum pump. In order to keep the vacuum very high inside of the glass envelope for a very long time, they develop this kind of effect, assist. So every vacuum tube has this, and you can tell whether the glass envelope is cracked, because if air comes inside of the vacuum tube, this becomes white and is not shiny as it appears here. So vacuum tubes at one moment have been also a strategic war component, and I would like to spend a few words about the EF50, that was a pentode developed in 1939. And Philips developed that vacuum tube for high frequency TV receiver sets that were developing at the time. This vacuum tube is notable because the fabrication of its base represented a departure from traditional tube manufacturing, that at the time was still based on light bulb techniques. It's not a chance that many producers of vacuum tubes started to produce light bulbs at the end of the 19th century. Starting from now, the techniques have been improved, and in particular, the base of the EF50 was different from the standard fabrication techniques in order to improve the high frequency characteristics. And at the same time, 1939, England was developing their radar system and was searching for a way to miniaturize receivers for airborne radars, so radars that are meant to be put on airplanes. They couldn't wait a ton. The EF50 was perfect for that. But there was a problem. the A50 was developed by Philips in Holland, and the Nazi Germany was about to start the war, or has already been started the war with the invasion of Poland. So people began to realize that they need in England the EF-50, but the production, the mass production of the E-50 was done in Holland by Philips. So an agreement has been reached between Philips and Muller, that was English producer of vacuum tubes. And the May 9th of 1940, a truck was loaded with 25,000 complete tubes, and a certain number of bases for building new tubes and some fabrication tools. The truck get out the evening from the Philips factory, and the next morning the Holland has been indicted by Nazi Germany. And the truck come to The Hague. The vacuum tubes and the other goods were loaded into a ship towards the England, and the ship has been bombed by German planes, by Nazi planes. So it's a pretty dramatic history. They could get the tubes in England, and they probably have played a role in the Battle of Britain, where Germany tried to invade England but couldn't, because it was stopped by the strategy, but also by the radar systems that has been developed by the Allies, in particular by the English technicians. So on a completely other side, also in 1939, this is a schematic of a very fortunate type of AM radio receiver. So it's a consumer product. It's called the AA5. Many companies have produced this in the United States. AA means All American 5. And the 5 is the number of vacuum tubes that you have in this design. So it's a pretty simple circuit. Only 5 vacuum tubes to receive an amplitude modulated signal. So it's a heterodyne receiver. If you know what is an heterodyne, basically you have a local oscillator that creates a signal that is mixed with the received signal. Then you have the intermediate frequency signal that is filtered and then detected. And here, for example, if you take the first vacuum tube that you have on the left, so the 12SA7GT, this is a heptode, so it's a step forward with respect to the pentode, but in reality this is sort of a mix of several vacuum tubes in order to do two functions. The first is to have a local oscillator to amplify the received signals from the antenna. The antenna is the AG that you have on the left. And also mix the signals. So you have 3 functions that are accomplished by the same vacuum tube. Then you have the 2 transformers are in reality tuned transformers in order to filter the down-converted signal at 455 kilohertz. In the schematic, you see KC, because in 1939, the measurement unit of the frequency wasn't still half. So C stands for cycles, so kilocycles. And in 1960, I believe that hertz was used and declared as the measurement unit for the frequency. Then another interesting thing is the third vacuum tube that you have in the middle of the schematic is the 12SQ7GT that contains a triode and two diodes. So the two diodes are used for the detection of the signal, so getting the demodulated signals from the intermediate fragment. And the triad provides the first step of amplification of such a signal. Then the intermediate frequency is shocked. The last element is the 5OL6GT, that is a kinkless tetrode that is used for the audio amplification and for the speaker. And then you have the vacuum tube in the bottom is used for rectifying directly the mains voltage, because since it's a consumer component, the principal priority was to keep costs down. So you don't have the power transformer. People were lucky in the United States that the mains voltage is relatively low, because in Europe it would have been criminal to do things like that. But the chassis was live. You know, the chassis is the metallic box where you attach the different elements in such a circuit. Since you don't have any power transformer to power the circuit, basically, if you are not lucky, you have your chassis, so the metallic box inside of the radio, that is directly connected to the to the mains, so potentially dangerous voltage. Imagine touching the shaft of a potentiometer where the knob has broken and getting shocked. And also the different filaments were running parallel, so that they were made such as they have the same rating for the current, and the voltage added up is the mains voltage in the United States. So 1940, 1950 is the peak. A transistor has been invented in 1948, as we have seen in the 47, 48, as we have seen in Cantin's seminar, but they weren't ready at the time. You have plenty of examples of electronic circuits. So here I've selected some of them. Operational amplifiers were born for analog computing. So this is the K2W from Philbrick in 1952. We began to have digital computers. So this is the ENIAC 1945, operating until 1955. ENIAC has hundreds of thousands of vacuum tubes, and the problem was that their reliability wasn't very good, because vacuum tubes tend to wear out. So when you have one vacuum tube, then you spend more time repairing them than operating the computer. And then, of course, you have consumer electronics, radio, TV sets, and, of course, the invention of distorted guitars at the end of 1940s. So there is a nice YouTube video about that. I have cited some guitarists that first tried to use the defects of guitar amplifiers in order to create a sound that was pleasant, more rich, and somehow artistically interesting. In 1960, the transistors became really competitive. We still have some advantages of vacuum tubes. They are rugged, especially on the electrical point of view. You can overload a vacuum tube, depending on the overload, but you can exceed the maximum ratings, usually for a few seconds. You have the plate that glows red, and you say, oh, there is something that is not correct. You can switch off your equipment, and most of the times you can save the vacuum tube. You can do the same as transistors, where the thermal phenomena, for example, are much. There are well known. In 1960, people knew how to build the circuits with vacuum tubes. The industry was huge, and a wide variety of them was available. So, of course, transistors have plenty of advantages. High gain, small size. They have seen an example of vacuum tubes having different functions embedded inside of them, but this was limited because it's a sort of a mechanical complexity. You don't have the possibility of building integrated circuits. A limited lifetime, where, as we've seen, tubes wear out. And also you have high current capability at low voltages, and this is something that was extremely difficult to be obtained with vacuum tubes. Usually with vacuum tubes you have voltages of several hundreds for currents of a few milliamps. Of course, this is a typical example. You have extreme. But transistors are much better for low impedance applications, for to drive a loudspeaker. And you don't have any filament in a transistor, so you don't have any static power consumption in the sense of power, electrical power wasted in heat. In 1917 is the end of the era of vacuum tubes, basically. When I'm saying vacuum tubes, I mean diodes, triodes, and pentodes, because the last vacuum tube that is still used today in consumer application, I believe it's the magnetron in microwave ovens. But for other kinds of applications, this is the General Electric Portacolor built until 1978. And this is a collector item, apparently, because it's the last TV sets built around vacuum tubes that was built until 1978, so the end of the 1970s. So, today, apparently there are some very high power applications for in radio frequency. I'm not an expert on that, so I'm not aware of that. I'm aware that vacuum tubes are still produced, in particular in Eastern Europe and in Asia, and there is probably for the consumer market, one legitimate application that is the guitar amplifiers. It's perfectly legitimate for me that a guitarist wants to reproduce a certain sound from the 1960s for artistic purposes, and it's somehow philologic that guitar amplifiers can be built with the same technology that was available then, back then. So, for me, it's perfectly normal that guitar amplifiers are still produced, some guitar amplifiers are still produced this way, and vacuum tubes are still used this way. It's like a violinist that wants to use a violin from Guarnieri del Gesù or Stradivari. It's a very, very particular sound. And being able to reproduce the sound with modern amplifiers is something that is important. For me, it's circuit fun because I like circuits, I like electronic circuits, and vacuum tubes are fascinating. We have an advantage that the SPICE models exist for vacuum tubes and work pretty well, from my experience. But beware of magic thinking and audiophile nonsense. And the problem, for example, in many Wikipedia pages is that there are a certain number of things that are reasonable, and then there are completely nonsense things about vacuum tubes, the differences between vacuum tubes and transistors that are utter nonsense. So, in conclusion, we have said something about diodes, triodes, pentodes. They have been real solutions for real problems. They have tightly linked to light bulbs until 1930s. And they created the field of electronics. Oh, by the way, I've said that the electronics was called this way back in 1897. The term electronics began to appear in the general public in 1940s, more or less, before people talking about radios. And for example, if you take the local history, the ENSERG, I studied at the ENSERG, École Nationale Supérieure d'Électronique et Radioélectricité de Grenoble. ENSERG was born in 1957. You have the term radioelectricity that is still used, that somehow traced back to this history. But of course, in 1957, the term electronics was there, at least in France. And to end with vacuum tubes, they paved the way for the transistors and the electronics as it is today. So thank you for your attention. If you have questions, I hope that you are still alive.